for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. You gotta admit, even if you don't like Fear, you have to admit, Fear rules. Alright. It's, Monday morning. I know it's, you know, middle of the daytime to most of y'all, but it's Monday morning to me. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. This is, antiwar.com, and it's also Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Thanks very much for listening. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. Real quick, I'll tell you about my websites. TheStressBlog.com is where I write stuff. And I have a lot of really good bloggers that take part as well. Anthony Gregory from the Independent Institute writes there from time to time. Angela Keaton, the executive director of the Libertarian Party of California and former Austin radio show host. Haven't heard from Derek in a while. Ken has been doing a great job lately. Ken is a new blogger at Stress. He's a longtime friend of the show. And, he's just been blogging up a storm. And then, of course, Mud Shark, Oscar Goldman, and Vineyard Saker, three other new bloggers who, have all three been writing a lot of good stuff. Lukery from the What Is It Good For blog, which is, your number one source of information in the world if you want to learn about the Sybelle Edmonds story. He takes part over here as Stress sometimes as well. So, yeah, I invite everybody to check it out. You know, more people, in the comment section going back and forth, the better. And, I have to tell you, I really consider myself very lucky with some of the comments I read. This is, I guess I sort of feel like, my blog is an exclusive kind of group because I read a lot of blogs and I don't ever read commentary like I find just in the comment section. Never mind my wonderful, insightful blog posts that I put up there. But just in the comments section, these guys get into the insanest of intellectual subjects. It's really impressive. And, so that's thestressblog.com. Check it out. Also scotthortonshow.com is where I keep the archives of all my radio interviews going back to, Radio Chaos, April 9th, 2003, when I first started the Philip Drew interviews. They're all there. That was Alan Bach from antiwar.com was my first guest. Which brings me to antiwar.com, your very best source for news, viewpoints, and anti-war activities. Basically, everything that's going on in the world every day, updated in real time, constantly, in the middle of the night, in the middle of the day, on Christmas, on New Year's, on any hour of any day, important breaking news, it's immediately at the top of the page at antiwar.com, featuring credible sources from all around the world. That's antiwar.com, and you can find the archives not only of the interviews that take place on this show, Anti-War Radio, on Radio Chaos in Austin, but also the interviews of Charles Goyette, the great libertarian, very, very anti-war radio host from Phoenix, Arizona. He does the morning show on 1100 AM KFNX there in Phoenix. And it's great. I love talking to Charles Goyette. The guy's a Barry Goldwater conservative type. He's the kind of guy that looks at the Republican Party now and goes, what a bunch of pinkos. Global Democratic Revolution. You know, what is this, the Fourth International? And I like that. I like people who are, you know, basically former conservatives who have become, you know, strict plumb line anti-war libertarians for individual liberty and for limiting government. It's the Ron Paul soundbite. He figured it out. I don't know if it took him all 71 of his years to get it down, but I'll just go ahead and rip it off from Dr. Paul. It's the best soundbite. I'm for non-interventionism. I'm for non-intervention in your personal life. I'm for non-intervention in the economy. And I'm for non-intervention in the affairs of other countries overseas. If that's not the best summation of the libertarian perspective in one short soundbite for the TV audience or what have you, then I don't know what is. So congratulations for Dr. Paul for coining that one. And hope you don't mind if I plagiarize you. But that is what it's about. It's about non-intervention. It recognizes that when you have interventions in the economy, even, you know, as determined by the democracy, in order to do the right thing, that what you end up doing is you end up turning that police power, that regulatory power, over to the people who are supposedly being regulated. One group of them over the other and what have you. And it's always special interests in any government activity, no matter what the motivations of the people who supported it. Eventually, the people who actually have a vested interest in doing the regulating are going to turn it into a political football and work their magic, pay for the campaigns of their favorite congressman, and they're going to get it their way. That's how it always works. I don't know how many times, and I don't even really read the Lost American Statesman anymore. I don't know how many times I've read in the Statesman an environmental lawsuit was dismissed today when the judge said, I'm sorry, it looks to me like they're polluting on your property and affecting you negatively. However, the executive branch regulators came out and said that they were all good. So, case dismissed. That's how that works. So, and intervention in your personal life. You know, a lot of people do some things that, you know, others don't approve of. Well, for example, I have fairly strong opinions about golf. I think golf is just stupid and pathetic. It's a giant waste of time. I like George Carlin's whole thing about why do you need all that land when the ball is this freaking big? I think golf is not a sport. I think it's lame. And I think it's really at the golf course where the businessmen and the politicians go on the weekend together to figure out exactly who's going to regulate who and to what benefit. I think that's probably a lot of where that goes. But I also recognize that, hey, it's private property and they can do with it what they want. And that really, if it came down to, you know, banning things that people don't like, it would be my skateboard that got taken away long before it would be these rich pricks' golf courses, right? So, at the end of the day, personal behavior that I don't approve of isn't any of my business as long as it's all consensual. As long as nobody is using force to get their way, then we need to live and let live. I think. And I also think, you know, for those conservatives who think that you have to use state power to protect Western civilization from the forces of secular humanist liberalism, blah, 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 you might have noticed that it's your wonderful state that you worship so much that you supposedly give the authority to protect your wonderful Christian nation values or whatever that's doing all the destroying of your values. You notice it's the state's wars that primarily you support that take our society and shake the hell out of it and see what ends up on the other side. It's the state that pays people to break up their families from the advent of the nuclear family in order to get on the dole back during the Great Depression. Got to prove that you don't have any extended family to get on the dole. Oh, all of a sudden, the nuclear family in America. And then, of course, we all know that anybody wants to get welfare now, not only are you going to be investigated to see if you're allowed to keep your kids as just, you know, the tripwire for going to ask for some food stamps, but they'll tell you, you know, kick your man out of the house and come back and we'll give you some money. That's as simple as that. And I'm not saying it's necessarily on purpose. I think it's really just the effect. That's what happened. Well, we got to give welfare to single mothers or else what are they going to do? They're poor little babies. And so what does that mean? In effect, you know, in terms of economics and incentives, it means that the state is saying to people, we'll pay you to break up your family, right? And this is the state that the conservatives want to use to conserve their wonderful old traditional society that, you know, really never existed anyway. And in intervention overseas, don't want to go around intervening overseas, do you? Look at what a disaster it is. And you know, the fact is I can say that, and I know that most of you agree with me now. Pretty much everybody agrees with me now. I got, in fact, hang on one sec. Let's see if I can find this. Yeah, here it is. Remember my guest from last Friday, Jim Loeb from the Interpress Service? He wrote this great article back on April 5th, 2007. Public anxiety over foreign policy nears crisis. And it's about these massive leaps in the numbers indicating Americans' unwillingness to be, as Ron Paul says, the policeman of the world. That's not America's role in the world. We're the first country to successfully declare independence from the British Empire. We don't want to be like them. We're anti-colonialists. Remember George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and them? The American Revolution against empire? That's America's legacy. And I understand that the neocons invoke that anti-imperialist legacy to justify, you know, taking on Saddam Hussein and so forth. But obviously, that's ridiculous. We all see through that now. And we have that Vietnam syndrome again in America, don't we? I hope. That says that it's not America's business to go around intervening in foreign countries' affairs. Look at it this way. Woodrow Wilson got us into World War I for no good reason at all. In fact, based on lies. Based on the idea, literally, you might not know this, based on the theory that somehow the Germans were going to help the Mexicans invade and take back the Southwest. Okay? When the Germans couldn't even get their navy out of port. All right? That was the pretext upon which America entered World War I. And doing so, they, part of this same program, Woodrow Wilson bribed Kerensky, the interim government, the head of the interim government in Russia, to stay in the war longer, setting up the circumstances where on their fourth attempt in October 1917, Lenin and Trotsky were able to seize power and create the Soviet Union. And also allowed Britain and France to dictate the Versailles Treaty to Germany, which completely destroyed their economy, put on them the cost of all sides of the whole war. Yeah, right. Completely destroyed them, humiliated them, broke up not just parts of their empire, but stole parts of, you know, actual German territory. And set up for the rise of Adolf Hitler, and everybody knows that. You're allowed to talk about blowback, in fact, in terms of World War One now. You can, it's okay. It's legit in public, even probably in a Republican debate, you could even say. The terms of the Versailles Treaty and the destruction that America's entry into World War One allowed to take place against the Germans is what allowed for this doofus, nobody, failed artist, Nazi Hitler to take power in that country. It's the only way that Germany, which was a very reasonable society most of the time, would turn to a fanatic to basically get them out of the treaty and rebuild their country and promise them glory, etc. So it was all Woodrow Wilson's fault that the Soviet Union was created and that Nazi Germany was created in the first place at all. And then, of course, we had to intervene in World War II because we had to save the Soviet Union from the Nazis, because Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss and Harry Hopkins and, well, they were all KGB agents. And, of course, Franklin Roosevelt considered Stalin his good friend and instructed the press and the American people to refer to him as Uncle Joe. And I know they tell you it was about saving Britain, but Germany had already decided not to invade Britain, and the British knew that. They were trying to invade the Soviet Union, so America had to go and save the Soviet Union. And then, of course, we propped up all kinds of right-wing regimes. We financed the Mujahideen. We did the coup d'etat in Iran. We fought no-win wars in Korea and Vietnam. We're lucky we don't have too much blowback from those two, although the demilitarized zone in Korea is still a fairly hot spot, or potentially hot spot. But in fighting the Cold War, we created the Mujahideen. We financed them, trained them, gave them Stinger missiles, and gave them, most importantly, the experience of defeating an empire from their point of view through their faith in Allah and a superpower. And of course, when the backlash from our Cold War tactic coup in Iran came, in the form of the Iranian revolutionaries in 79, we had to throw all our support behind Saddam Hussein. Not that we weren't still selling weapons to the Iranians, too, because we were, of course, or the U.S. government was, Eric Edelman and them particularly. But we had to support that Saddam Hussein. And then when he got too big for his britches and went over there and misunderstood his instructions, apparently, and invaded all of Kuwait instead of just the northern oil fields, well, then we had to have a war against him. And in doing so, and in occupying Saudi Arabian bases in order to wage that war against Saddam Hussein, we pissed off our friends, the Mujahideen, Osama bin Laden and his buddies, now rechristened Al-Qaeda, our enemy, who have killed total well over 3,000 Americans, maybe over 4,000 at this point, and, you know, adding them all up through the 1990s and so forth. And the solution, according to George Bush and every Democrat that participated in the debate last night, apparently, is to continue intervening, to occupy more countries, to change more regimes. They say, yeah, it's true. It's not that they're fighting against our freedom. It's not that they hate freedom. They're fighting for their freedom. But the problem is that Iraq, Iran, and Syria aren't free countries. And so we got to do regime changes there, even though all the terrorists come from not free countries that are our allies, Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Yemen and so forth. And gee whiz, we're not forcing democracy on them. We're not making those countries free. We call those states moderate Arab states, the military dictatorships in Egypt and in Saudi Arabia. So they admit it's not that they hate us because we're free. It's they hate us because they're not free, and they blame us for it. Only check your enemies list, or check George Bush's enemies list with the countries where these terrorists actually come from. Uh-oh. Yeah, it turns out that more interventionism is only making matters worse. Of course, all the evidence from Iraq bears that out. Every intelligence agency on earth, including George W. Bush's good friend Porter Goss, when he was the director of Central Intelligence, testified to the U.S. Senate that America has turned Iraq into a training ground I heard somebody call an American prison Gladiator Academy one time. I guess that's a pretty apt description of what's happened in Iraq. America has created Gladiator Academy, where people who want to be ultimate warriors and die killing infidels and so forth can just come on into Iraq. And in fact, one of the Mujahideen put on a website a few weeks back that Iraq is terrorism university. Again, thanks to the United States. As predicted by many people who said, look, if you invade Iraq, you're going to turn it into one of these quote-unquote failed states where terrorists thrive. Saddam Hussein is a real jerk, but he has a monopoly on power, and he's a secularist. Leave him alone. He's not allowing terrorism to thrive there. The only place that there were any terrorist groups in Iraq before the war was in Kurdistan, where America was protecting the Kurds, and specifically Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his NR al-Islam. So here we are, continuing down the path of Woodrow Wilson's intervention in the First World War, and again, doing nothing but creating more problems for ourselves. I guess you guys saw the headlines this morning, probably right, that Turkey's shelling Kurdistan. Anybody who listened to my show on Free Radio Austin in 1999 knows that Turkey was backing, the United States was backing Turkey in their suppression of the Kurds. They were killing Kurds in Turkey, and America was on Turkey's side. Hey, they're our loyal NATO ally, right? And now we're backing the Kurds in Kurdistan. They're the most friendly to the Americans of all the different groups in Iraq, apparently, their leadership at least. And, what are we going to do? We're gonna liberate Kurdistan, let them have their own little country up there, at least federal, nominally perhaps under the control of Baghdad in the future, but perhaps not even that. And then the Kurds, of course, are going to create their own state, and they're going to launch whatever operations they can in order to bring in Kurdish parts of Iran, Syria, of Turkey. And we're just setting ourselves up for more crisis. In fact, it's funny, in that movie V for Vendetta, they referred to the Kurdistan campaign, which I thought I liked that. It was like, on the news. Today, in the former United States, that kind of thing on the background on the news. The Kurdistan campaign. It's coming. And who knows what interventions are headed down the line. Obviously, we've made, as discussed with Ivan Elin on the show Thursday or last Wednesday or something, where Ivan Elin talked about how, because of America's policy in Pakistan, we are putting the stability of that country in major danger. That, Musharraf was a dictator, but there was still very large, I guess still is, very large, educated, middle and upper middle class that has power, centers of power, civil society, whatever, organizations throughout Pakistan, that this was not just, the land of fanatics. And yet, of course, because America has so carefully tied Musharraf's identity to ours, all the radicalism's on the rise there, and they got nuclear weapons. So, non-interventionism in foreign policy seems to me the best way to go. Now, does that mean that the whole world is going to be peaches and cream? No, it just means that they won't be killing us. I mean, right now, you ask the average guy on Earth, what's the problem? And they'll tell you, America's foreign policy. There's no state on Earth today that is an aggressor against other states. It's just us. I mean, you got civil wars going on in Sri Lanka, you got border disputes in Kashmir. But, last I heard, Kazakhstan hadn't invaded Uzbekistan or anything, It's America. We're the aggressors. We're putting everybody off. And yet, you hear the same rhetoric that I do, that, they don't really hate Americans, they just hate our government a lot. But that only goes so far, particularly when our government's rhetoric is about what a wonderful democracy we are and about how everything our government does it because the people rule here. We, the people, in order to form a more perfect union and all that crap. As long as we're selling all this warfare in the name of, oh yeah, the American people demand it, all right, and that's why we're here, I don't know how long we're going to be able to get away with ignoring responsibility for that, but I don't know. Basically, that's my 25-minute pitch for non-intervention. Non-intervention. You leave people alone, respect their private property, you make a deal, keep your end of it. Don't violate each other's rights. Don't mouth off that there ought to be a law every time you hear something you disagree with. You know? Live and let live. Leave people alone so that you can live in the kind of society where they leave you alone, right? Yeah. It's funny how people just think some people just completely believe in that when it comes to the way things are here. But somehow they tie it to foreign war that we couldn't live and let live and have freedom here, except for the fact that we refuse to allow people to live and let live overseas. That's called fighting for our freedom. If, you know, if we weren't killing people overseas all the time, well, we'd all be speaking Arabic right now. Brr. Fighting for our freedom. And what it really is going around killing people. Does anybody besides me care that Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are still alive in June of 2007? And will probably still be alive and podcasting from the Hindu Kush, you know, when Bush and Cheney leave office? Besides the 19 who died that day, who were actually the ones responsible, their leaders and people who gave them their orders and money and cooperated and so forth, those people are responsible, and they've not been held to account. You know, the Lancet Medical Journal and the British government agrees with it. Say that, and this is from, as Dar Jamil explained on the show last week, the legwork on this study was done last July. They said that 600,000-something Iraqis have died. 600,000-something Iraqis had nothing to do with the attacks against us at all, except that our previous bombing of them had helped, from bases in Saudi Arabia, had helped to motivate the attackers. Other than that, had nothing to do with the attack. And they're dead. 600,000-something of them. While bin Laden and Zawahiri, who presumably are, you know, living at some guy's house in the mountains somewhere in northwestern Pakistan, they're just, I guess, chilling in a hammock right now, what, drinking pina coladas and relaxing? Here's some news. This is thanks to Ken at the Stress Blog. U.S. can't win in Iraq. General. That's the headline. Well, which general? Tell me, Scott, which general is it that's now come forward saying we can't win in Iraq? San Antonio, Texas, the man who led coalition forces in Iraq during the first year of the occupation, says the United States can forget about winning the war. I think if we do the right things politically and economically with the right Iraqi leadership, we could still salvage at least a stalemate, if you will. Not a stalemate, but at least stave off defeat. Retired Army Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez said in an interview. You remember Sanchez, right? The guy took over for Tommy Franks, or... who was it? I forgot. I think he was the head of CENTCOM, right? Sanchez, in his first interview since he retired last year, is the highest-ranking former military leader yet to suggest the Bush administration fell short in Iraq. I'm absolutely convinced that America has a crisis in leadership this time, Sanchez says. said after a recent speech in San Antonio, Texas. I wonder if he could be referring to his own mandating of the torture of innocent people in Iraq. I wonder if that is any part of the crisis of leadership he's referring to. We've got to do whatever we can to help the next generation of leaders do better than we have done over the past 5 years. Oh, he said we there. Maybe he is taking responsibility for torturing all those poor people, 90% of whom, well, to be fair, 70 to 90% of whom, according to the Army, were completely innocent people just rounded up in sweeps. Yeah. We've got to do whatever we can to help the next generation of leaders do better than we have done over the past 5 years, better than what this cohort of political and military leaders have done, adding that he was referring to our national political leadership in its entirety, not just George Bush. Sanchez called the situation in Iraq bleak and blamed it on the abysmal performance in the early stages and the transition of sovereignty. He included himself among those who erred in Iraq's crucial first year after Saddam. Wow. Sounds to me like Ricardo Sanchez needs to pack up his stuff and move away if he doesn't like it. Right? That's funny. I wonder, like, if I had kept count on a piece of paper somewhere, how many people told me that I had to leave America because I didn't like Sanchez. And I thought he was doing a crappy job of killing people in the country that he helped to aggressively invade. I wonder how many. I look at the polls now, it says 75% of the American people say the Iraq war is going badly. More than 60% want out now. Or, you know, as soon as practical. Well, awesome. You hear that, folks? That means that, you know, 30, 40% of us get to have this whole country to ourselves. Because the supermajority is now going to pack their shit and leave. All those people who told me I had to leave because I criticized Ricardo Sanchez. I said, you know, Ricardo Sanchez is doing a really lousy job of killing and torturing people over there in this aggressive war that he helped launch, and I don't like it. People said, well, you don't like it, boy. You can just leave. Sanchez over there fighting for your freedom, boy. Okay, well, now that Sanchez is on my side, I suggest all you people pack your shit and move to Iraq. One of you people all go fight this battle that you suggested was so honorable back before you recanted. Why don't you go take the place of an 18-year-old kid who got tricked into going based on the lies that you helped tell him? You know, if I was one of these idiots who supported this war and who denounced all the anti-war people, I would at least have the courage and my conviction to go over there and take a bullet in the place of some 17-year-old, 18, 19-year-old kid over there. You know, you read the headlines, all these kids are dying from homemade bombs on the side of the road. How'd you like that? 19, 20-year-old kid blown apart by a homemade bomb on the side of the road. His friends who, you know, pick up his pieces don't even have an enemy to shoot at. They can't even see anybody to shoot at. Can you imagine how frustrating that must be? Fighting, you know, like an episode of Scooby-Doo or something. Fighting ghosts. So, you know, I don't know. I think Sanchez should re-enlist as a private. That's what I think. Yeah, real sorry about that really crappy job I did over there in Iraq. But, yeah, we're gonna be there forever. And more kids are going to die there. Sorry. Yep, did a bad job. I mean, look at this. 14 more, it says in this same article. 14 more soldiers killed in action in Iraq in a series of bomb attacks. And now George Bush says that this is proof that it's working. See, the worse it gets, well, that just proves that the terrorists are desperate. And there are Americans still who believe that. There are Americans still who believe that. Isn't that cool? I'm glad that Americans are so detached. In a way, it's kind of comedic. You know? You look at the greatest limited republic in the name of freedom ever conceived in all of humanity, and it can't even last a couple of hundred years. You know? It's It's kind of ridiculous, seems like. Anyway, I'm just sitting here going off. I should have given out the phone number so you guys could interrupt me and shut my mouth and get your two cents in here. It's 512-646-6446. 512-646-6446. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin. All right, Charles, this is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and again, the phone number here is 646-6446-646-6446. 512 is the area code if you're calling from out of town, 512-646-6446. Be happy to take y'all's calls. I guess I should talk about the damn Democrats. Did anybody see that debate last night? I saw the second hour. It was 2 hours long. I saw the second hour, and I barely watched any of it. And I really don't care. You know, I guess I would have liked to have seen Mike Gravel come out and talk some mad shit like he did last time, but he didn't. Not that they really gave him a chance. It's pretty obvious, you know. I didn't see, I didn't see the first hour. But in the second hour, I saw clips of the first hour. I know that they were all standing at podiums, and it was kind of a different arrangement, but... in the second hour, they were all sitting in chairs, and it's funny. It kind of reminded me of the chairs at the train station. I remember from when I was a little kid, where it's like two of these kind of molded plastic chairs, and then a little round table, and then two more, and then a little round table. You picturing what I'm saying? So they have all the candidates that TV wants you to pay attention to. Are in the middle with one table between them, basically. I guess it was like three chairs and then a table, something like that. I forget. Maybe it was two. Anyway, but they got Mike Gravel and Dennis Kucinich way out on the fringes, on the wings, on the margins. And I'm not a real big Dennis Kucinich fan. Honestly, if he was running for president, I'd vote against him. I mean, the guy wants to give our military to the United Nations to choose what to do with. I mean, forget it. I don't agree with him about America being a communist country as, you know, some great hope for the future. However, he does have some very important things to say about American foreign policy. Not that they're all right, but a lot of them are important, and he's very anti-war. What they stick him way over on the edge. And same thing with Mike Gravel. And you could see Mike Gravel going, excuse me, I'd like to answer that, because these are the second hour was all questions from the audience, none of whom said, yeah, my question is for Barack. They all went, I kind of would like to know what y'all think about this or that. Well, anyway, you could see Gravel when they would show the faraway shot. You could see Gravel's hand going up. I want to answer that. But his mic was off. And they, you know, what is this, Germany or something? Like, I'm too stupid to imagine that somebody, obviously, at CNN said, okay, now make sure that the way the stage is set up, that Gravel and Kucinich are out on the, literally, visually, on the margins of this debate. I'm so stupid, I'm gonna think that's an accident, or what? What are you trying to tell me, CNN? Why, look, honey, the TV seems to indicate that I shouldn't really listen to this Gravel or this Kucinich guy because they're literally visually on the margins of this debate. Yes, the truth is in there somewhere between Barack Obama and John Edwards. Clearly. And besides all that, the debate was a disgrace. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, all of them. You know, Joe Biden, I challenge all the rest of you to say that we ought to bomb Sudan. Come on! No fly zones! Let's get it! No fly zones! Let's see, what do we know about no fly zones? What comes after no fly zones? Oh yeah, bombing. Murder. You know, these people, are supposedly have the job of protecting the sovereignty of this country, and yet, do they recognize the sovereignty of any other country in the world? Oh, you don't like what's going on in Sudan? Well, that's fine. We'll just put our Air Force over their country. And then, you know, Biden wants to send in ground troops. Oh, don't worry. We could wipe out the John's weed in no time, and then the whole thing would be over. It'd be great. It'd be just like Iraq. We'll just go in there and get Saddam and get out. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What I was wondering is if you could address an argument that I heard on NPR put forth by Ted Koppel. He said, and this was he talked about the war in Iraq, 3,000 casualties, and compared it to the 40, 50,000 people a year that die in their cars, driving, and so forth. And the argument he made was, we need to stay in Iraq because we need to make sure that the oil keeps pumping and it preserves our way of life. He was essentially insinuating it's a necessary cost. Otherwise, otherwise chaos will ensue throughout the region. They won't sell us oil, and we won't be able to drive our cars. He was saying the fact that we're willing to take 40,000 casualties on the roads every year implies that the 800 or 900 a year that we're losing in Iraq is tolerable as a way to preserve our way of life. And this was on NPR. It actually surprised me, and I was pretty upset about it, but I was hoping you could address the argument that he put forth.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I think that's great. There you have it, folks. There you have it. It's okay that 3,000 people died on September 11th. That's the price you got to pay for empire. It's okay that 3,500 Americans have lost their lives from sniper bullets and roadside bombs by aggressively invading a country that never attacked us and killing 600,000 of them. Because, hey, that's the price you pay for being an empire. And further, it shows the collectivist, it further shows the collectivist viewpoint of Ted Koppel. I mean, I gotta really appreciate that. That's the most honest appraisal of the situation from the point of view of the war party I think I've ever heard. Human beings aren't individuals. That guy that dies in the car wreck down the street, that's a terrible tragedy when it happens. That he's just part of some statistic. And those Americans who die over there and, leave their babies and their new wives and their shattered families behind, whatever. That's just a number. These aren't people to Ted Koppel. And even if they were, even if you can force them to admit, man, these are people's lives being shattered here. His answer is, it's worth it. Okay. And now to the second point, whether it's necessary for the American military to occupy Iraq in order to get that oil, I suggest the opposite is true. I think that, Greg Palast is right. That the Colin Powell, James Baker, Rice University Council on Foreign Relations plan for Iraq was to do a regime change there, replace Saddam with the next Ba'athist general in line, and keep that oil off the market. The big crisis of the entry of the Bush years, the coming of the Bush years, was that something was going to have to be done about the Iraq sanctions, that you were going to have to be lifted or changed or altered or something was going to have to happen there. And they didn't want that oil to hit the market. They, especially when Saddam Hussein, after being let out of his box, would certainly not be going along with what America wants, but would obviously be much more likely to move towards the Russians or the French and the Germans, etc. And so something had to be done in order to keep that oil off the market, in order to keep Saudi Arabia the dominant force in OPEC, to keep their sales denominated in dollars, and to maintain American hegemony. I believe that that Palast actually falls short in explaining how the neocons, who are basically traitors, who put the interests of Israel first, not that they are any good at perceiving what the actual interests of Israel are, but what they think are Israel's interests before the interests of the United States, and rather than trying to do some sort of coup d'etat, invasion disguised as a coup, as Palast calls it, they went for the full-on regime change, fire the whole government, fire the whole army, turn the place upside down, shatter it into a million pieces, and create this state of total war, which I think is also basically just as well for the oil companies, because as long as people are fighting and pipelines are being blown up and what have you, not much oil is being produced. The oil that is being produced in Iraq is not even metered. It's all just going straight into criminal syndicates. You know, there's no even real measurement of how much oil is getting out of there. And it's boosted the price. So I think that, as bin Laden himself said, quoted by Michael Scheuer, what do you think we're going to do? Drink it? We can't drink it. We'll sell it to you. So that assumes that even bin Laden, the center of all evil in the universe, is the dictator of Saudi Arabia. Even he's going to continue selling us oil. So, and the Cato Institute, sorry, one more thing. The Cato Institute did a massive study in the 1990s that said, look, this is how much we spend, quote-unquote, securing our oil, and this is how much we spend on our oil. And it's roughly the same number, and it's absolutely unnecessary.
Well, thanks for answering my question. I mean, the one thing that, and I kind of asked it in jest, because I follow anti-war enough to actually know a little bit more about this than probably not you, but more than the average NPR listener may, is, I mean, how is it that the fact checking that goes into all these things, that all the commentary and so forth that you hear, say from Ted Koppel, insinuating that basically our whole oil supply will be cut off unless we keep our troops in Iraq, which is, to me, it seems preposterous. There's no reason to believe that necessarily. How can the fact checking be so shoddy? Or if you look at the, I think it's Norman Podhoretz's op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal where he's praying for war with Iran. Essentially, that's what it was. He says that Ahmadinejad has essentially promised that he's going to wipe Israel off the map and so forth, and that it just amazes me that you can post opinions in these media, but the fact that the so-called factual claims they make to support their opinions, like this wipe Israel off the map thing, or the whole pipeline of oil into America from the Middle East will disappear unless we keep our troops there. I mean, how can they make these claims? And how do the people who run these organizations just let them get away with it? Because to me, it seems like a lot of these things are just very specious claims that they're making.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it's absolutely frustrating. I think about at antiwar.com, just we bend over backwards to hyperlink to, you know, beyond all reason to the evidence for our assertions to prove every single point that we make. And then you're right. You watch TV, you read the Wall Street Journal or listen to the radio most of the time, and it's like the land of no follow-up question. It's the kind of thing where, same thing last night after this Democrat debate, where they said, you know, Hillary Clinton said that, they asked the Hillary Clinton's little spin man after the debate. Hillary Clinton said that the Iraq vote was the most important vote of her career, and yet she also says that she didn't read the national intelligence estimate about Iraq that came out right before she took the vote. So what gives with that? And the guy's answer had absolutely nothing to do with the question at all. And so what does Anderson Cooper do? He goes right on to the next question. Instead of saying, hey, pal, I asked you a question. Why don't you answer me, coward? Which is what a reporter ought to do, right? There's no follow-up, ever. There is no, well, wait a minute, in that whole wiped off the map thing, taken a bit out of context, and there is no, well, aren't they 10 years away from being able to make a nuclear bomb? You're right. I mean, you got it. This is, you just put the name on my frustration. They base all these plans for all the mass murder that still is yet to be carried out, that needs to be carried out, and it's all based on things that are so easy to debunk and discredit, and yet aren't debunked and discredited.
That was my main frustration. Thanks for taking my call, Scott.
Hey, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it. And yeah, I mean, that's exactly the way I feel about it. It's, you know, what the hell, Anderson Cooper? Ask him the follow-up. Say to him, no, man, I asked you, how can Hillary Clinton vote for a war without reading the freaking National Intelligence Estimate? Or is it a lie that she didn't read the National Intelligence Estimate? Answer me! But, of course, Anderson Cooper's not a journalist. Anderson Cooper is a hairdo. And CNN is, you know, a reality TV show for people who like being entertained by politics. Has nothing to do with what's really important, what's really the news. The Daily Show, on the other hand, actually I have my problems, don't get me wrong. But I do love The Daily Show. And tonight, my friends, on The Daily Show, Ron Paul is going to be the guest. And I really hope that they don't clown him too much. I guess they're going to have to clown him a little bit because it's The Daily Show. But I'm pretty confident that Ron Paul is going to do great. And I just, I'm so thrilled by the response and all the excitement about Ron Paul's candidacy that's come forward. I don't know. I couldn't count. I really could not count for you how many times when I just Googled the name Ron Paul and kind of surfed through new blog entries and new news stories about it. You know, letters to the editors of various papers and who knows. I just can't tell you. I could not count how many times I've come across the words, I just found out about this guy, Ron Paul. I just heard Ron Paul's name the other day. I only just now spent my first hour and a half researching Ron Paul. I mean, I found this over and over and over again. And I'm so excited about that. And I don't, you know, I guess I shouldn't speak too negatively because you never know. I guess Ross Perot could just donate $1 billion for the Ron Paul campaign or something. But I don't have any illusions that Ron Paul is going to be the Republican nominee because there's nobody left in the GOP but the War Party. Everybody else has quit. Now, I suppose it's possible that, you know, a bunch of non-Republicans are all going to surge to the polls and actually outnumber the Republicans in the primaries. But I think that's very doubtful. But what is important, very important to me, is just knowing that his name is getting out there because you know what his name is connected to? Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of articles and speeches and lectures and question and answer sessions and newsletters and God knows what, all about liberty, about leaving the world alone, about gold money, about scaling back the power of the national government, preferably to pre-New Deal or even pre-Woodrow Wilson, pre-Theodore Roosevelt days. The Constitution of the United States actually being the law of the land, which, you know, it's not a perfect constitution. If we wanted, I could do a whole show all about how much I don't like the Constitution, but it's sure a hell of a lot better. Sure a hell of a lot better than what we have now. All right, I don't know. 646-6446-646-6446. I was trying to line up an interview with somebody from Amnesty International about this, their you know, world report. I had a bunch of stuff about Afghanistan in it, but I'm not prepared. I'm not prepared, so it didn't happen. But yeah, you guys could call in on your telephones. Take part in the show. If you like, 646-6446. 512-646-6446. And I guess I will get back to the front page of antiwar.com right now. Oh, you know what? I'm gonna start with my entries on the anti-war blog lately, folks. So, where are we at here? I don't believe them for a second. I posted this, according to this thing, Saturday, June 2nd. Is that right? Yeah, I think it was, it was Saturday that they announced the big, scary terrorist plot. The terrorists are going to blow up the JFK airport. That's right. They were going to set off a bomb on a pipeline, and then that was going to start a chain reaction that was going to blow up all these planes and trucks and innocent civilians burning to death. Oh no. And all day Saturday, and probably yesterday too, although I didn't watch TV yesterday, all day Saturday, footage of JFK airport, as though just keep watching and you might see an explosion. Even though what they're announcing is, you know, the arrest of these guys who, turns out, had no capability, no money, no resources, and an FBI informant for a friend. Isn't that funny how that works? So as soon as I heard about this story, I wrote this little ditty for the anti-war blog called, I Don't Believe Them for a Second. Yeah, big scary terrorist plot. Every time this happens, it turns out the whole damn thing was either made up by the state out of thin air, the idea to do something violent came from the undercover FBI informant, or the truth was tortured out of the guy. There is no Al-Qaeda in America. As always, the biggest threat to our lives and liberties is the national government of the United States. Now you know how the rest of the world feels. And then I just put my partial list of bogus domestic terrorism plots busted by the federal cops since September 11th. The Lackawanna 6, these are all the false prosecutions. Never mind all the false threats. Never mind, I still remember this one. This is never on anybody's list. In fact, I've tried to Google this before and couldn't even find it in the news, but I still remember. There's the Homeland Security is warning a terrorist threat to a school in Texas. That's all the information we have. I'm not sure, you know, how many people in the audience listening online and so forth have ever been to Texas, but there's a reason Texas used to be its own republic. It's humongous, man. You ever driven from the panhandle even to Austin, which is, you know, maybe two-thirds of the way to Mexico from there? It's freaking take it all day, man. More. Texas is huge. The number of schools, I have no idea. It must be in the tens of thousands. Homeland security threat. A school in Texas somewhere may be attacked by terrorists. That's all the information we have. Stay on alert. Okay. I'm not counting those. There are hundreds and hundreds of those. I'm only counting the false prosecutions. I'm only counting the Soviet-style rigged political show trials of the Lackawanna 6, the five in Detroit, the Virginia paintball terrorists, Abu Ali, who was tortured by the Saudis into so-called confessing to a plot to kill George Bush, Jose Padilla, the supposed dirty bomber, who we've covered at length on this show, the Lodi, California case, where the informant was paid $350,000 to put words in the mouth of this little kid and finally got away with it. The jury foreman announced that, yeah, we didn't see any actual evidence of any terrorism or a plot, but they proved many instances of his anti-Americanism. So yeah, he got sent, that's a direct quote. So he got sentenced to, 60 years or something like that. The Miami plot against the Sears Tower. Yeah, right. The local, gang in the ghetto in Liberty City, Miami. They were gonna go blow up the Sears Tower. All they needed from their FBI informant, $10, some shoes, a bus ticket, some explosives, guns, training. Yeah. Then there was the plot to blow up the New York subway tunnels. Remember that? Oh, actually, you know, maybe that was just a fake threat and not an actual prosecution. Doesn't belong on my list. But that was a hilarious one anyway. Remember that? Oh, yeah. They were going to blow up explosions in the tunnels. And then when all the water came into the tunnels, that was going to somehow flood New York City, which is above sea level. Uh-huh. Remember that? Yeah. Then there was the New York subway station. I forget the young man's name, but I interviewed. You can find the interview at Anti-War Radio at antiwar.com. My interview of Becky Akers, all about how the state entrapped this poor kid. The liquid explosives plot on the airlines from Britain to America, that's total bullshit, that every scientist in the world said, give me a break. Would you stop lying to the people like this? You know, there was a great one on in the papers in the UK that was like, okay, if I have all the chemicals that the government says these guys are going to blow up a bunch of planes with, you know, this is like some guy with the, you know, massive list of letters representing advanced degrees after his name. You know, actual scientist says, oh yeah, this is how I would do it. Well, I'd have to go into the bathroom and I need a bucket of ice and I would need, you know, these 10 instruments and I would need no one to pay any attention to me and I would need for no one on the plane to have a sense of smell and I would need, you know, 45 minutes to mix all this stuff together and hope I don't blow myself up and yeah. Probably would just start a small fire. Okay, so that was pure lies. And then the Fort Dix Six. Oh, Fort Dix. Ask Rudy Giuliani. He'll tell you this is why America has to stay in Iraq, because of the Fort Dix Six, who, if they are guilty, is simply another perfect example of blowback, as some of them were tied with the Kosovo Liberation Army, Bill Clinton's Mujahideen buddies from 1999. Oops, about that. But no, it turns out that there was just an FBI informant who made up that whole thing too. There was also the surface-to-air missiles. I guess that was in Canada. Yeah, they were going to buy some surface-to-air missiles. They were going to take a sword and cut the head off the prime minister. Lies, 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 lies. Not a single terrorism prosecution in this country since September 11th. And don't give me Moussaoui. They could have stopped the whole plot if they'd only investigated him within the law, which they refused to do. Every one of these cases has been an absolute fraud, a travesty of justice against the individuals who are innocent and falsely prosecuted, and a fraud against the American people. And I do think that there are more Al-Qaeda terrorists in the world today than there were before America invaded Iraq. Their ability to actually come to America and pull off a sophisticated, spectacular attack, I don't know. I don't think there's actually that much of a threat. But I do think that if Al-Qaeda, or you know, some offshoot claiming their name, it's really more of a movement than a group now anyway, isn't it? I think that if people really are determined to set off some spectacular attack in the United States and kill massive numbers of people again, I think that they'll probably succeed, because the FBI will be too busy screwing around arresting innocent people, prosecuting innocent people. 646-6446-646-6446. And then now here's the proof that I'm right. See, this always comes before too long. My second blog entry I posted last night. See, the JFK plot was bogus. Just like I said when the story broke from the Los Angeles Times, aviation experts cautioned Saturday that the alleged plot targeting JFK International Airport in New York would have faced many hurdles, not least of which is the fact that jet fuel does not easily explode. The level of catastrophe that may be created is much more limited than most people would expect, said the former head of security at Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion International Airport. The fuel that we are talking about is mostly jet fuel, which, unlike the gasoline most people put into their cars, is not susceptible to explosion. That difficulty apparently concerned one of the alleged plotters, an engineer who federal authorities said in their complaint explained to his associates that the tanks at JFK would probably require two explosions to provide enough oxygen to ignite the fuel. But even then, aviation security experts said, fire would not have spread through the pressurized pipelines that bring fuel out to the airplanes parked at gates. The probability that an explosion would travel through the pipeline and destroy targets along the tarmac is almost nil, said Ron, now president of New Age Security Solutions in Rockville, Maryland. The exception would be pipelines that are not in use. Duh. You ever seen a pipeline explosion on TV? It happens sometimes, right? And where does the fireball go? Up. It doesn't travel down the pipe. Why? Because there's no oxygen in the pipe. You need oxygen to burn stuff. Don't tell that to any of the reporters who spent their entire weekend screaming their heads off about this plot. Oh my goodness gracious, the danger. And from the New York Times, the criminal complaint filed by federal authorities against the four defendants in the case, one of them, Abdel Nur, remained at large yesterday, suggests a less than mature terror plan, a proposed effort longer on evil intent than on operational capability. Some law enforcement officials and engineers also dismissed the notion that the planned attack could have resulted in catastrophic chain reaction. System safeguards, they said, would have stopped explosions from spreading. Yeah, system safeguards such as you don't pump a bunch of oxygen through your fuel line. I like how the New York Times has to give the credit to, you know, some genius thing, which I'm sure there are, you know, automatic shutdown switches and stuff. Don't get me wrong, but the lack of oxygen, I think, you know, would be a little something. The complaint, hang on one sec, caller. The complaint filed in federal district court in Brooklyn also suggests at least two of the suspects had some ambivalence. One of the men was gaming for bombing the airport, but leery about killing masses of people. Another dropped out of the plot for a time to tend his business. As with many post, this is the New York Times talking, folks. As with many post 9/11 terror plots, the line between terrible aspiration and reality can get lost in a murky haze. In case after case, from what authorities said was a dirty bomber, Jose Padilla, to the Lackawanna Six, federal prosecutors hail arrests of terrorists and disruptions of what they describe as sinister plots. But as these legal cases unfold, the true nature of the threats can come into question. The papers give reason for doubt about the competence of the suspects in this case. The details tend to suggest a distance between Mr. DeFrita's dream and any nightmarish reality. There is, too, the question. This is, again, reading from the New York Times. There is, too, the question of the role played by the unidentified undercover informant who befriended Mr. DeFrita's. The informant is a convicted drug dealer, and his sentence is pending as part of his cooperation agreement with the federal government. Again, quoting the New York Times, many of the plot's larger details are left to the imagination. Yep, there you go. Take that and shove it, little green footballs, you idiots. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott.
What's up, Shauna?
Well, you know, this whole thing with these terrorists, it seems like instead of going out on the news when you can't get a bunch of guys with terrible aspirations that are talking about doing terrible things, you know, I think maybe they need to take a page from the Secret Service. You know how it is when you start popping off about killing the president or wishing the president was dead, you know, and the guy in the limo comes on over, comes, knocks on your door and scares the hell out of you and asks you what your, you know, what are, just what are your intentions toward the president? And
yeah, well, I can't say that's ever happened to me, but yeah, I've seen on TV. I know what you're talking about.
there have been a couple of people in Austin that I've met personally that got to visit.
Yeah.
One girl said she wished President Bush and her family would all die of a terrible disease, and she put it in her email that I guess was went out on a little list of people, and she got a little visit from the Secret Service. And, of course, nobody arrested her. You know, nobody did anything other than, hey, you know, we know what you said, and, you know, we take threats to the president very seriously, and we got our eyes on you.
Right, and what would be so hard if you really have, I mean, assuming that these guys had any real criminal intent aside from the words that the FBI informant was putting in their mouth, seems to me like that might be very effective. Have some, you know, guys in black suits and sunglasses come and knock on the door. Hey, man, what's all this about? You think you're going to blow up some things at JFK, huh? Well, don't think that we're not watching every move you make, pal. I mean, you know, with the level of doofuses that we see over and over in these cases being tricked by their federal informants into, basically entrapped into these terrorism cases, seems like if they had any intent of their own at all, that would be enough to snuff it out pretty quick.
Yeah.
These guys are not Muhammad at all.
There is something here that is more serious that's going on. And that is that it seems like our own population of Muslims is becoming more and more radicalized. Not that there's actually been anybody who's, you know, all, you know, got competence and the will and everything to follow through. But what we are seeing is a lot more ill will from within toward our system.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I'd say a little more.
And why is that? Isn't that because since 9/11, the Muslim population in this country has been targeted with special questioning and, you know, extra harsh treatment at the airport and various things. And then the war in Iraq. I've met a couple of Muslims personally that are very angry about the war in Iraq and other aspects of our foreign policy that seem to be, let's face it, directly aimed at Muslims. You know, if you want to believe that we have an anti-Muslim foreign policy, there is a lot of evidence to support that.
Yeah, well, I got to say, I kind of agree with you, and I kind of don't. In a sense, I think you're right that American Muslims are probably getting sick and tired of being harassed, and I'm sure they take a dim view, most of them, about American foreign policy in the Middle East. But on the other hand, I'd like to draw a pretty big distinction, I think, between American Muslims and European Muslims, where the Europeans, take France, for example, they don't ever really let the Muslims who've come there, who basically were invited there for cheap labor because the French are such socialists, they pay themselves to not work all day, so they need foreigners to come in and do jobs for them. And they bring in these giant Muslim populations, but they leave them in ghettos. They don't ever really invite them to become Frenchmen. They're not really brought into the society, where I think Muslims here in America consider themselves Americans to a much greater degree. They're not brought in as laborers the way, you know, we bring Mexicans in as laborers. They come here and get advanced degrees and own businesses and have wealth and put down roots in the community and stuff. So I don't think that I'd like to say I think there's a very distinct difference between the Muslim communities in America and the distance that they feel between this society and the way it is in Britain, France, and Germany, and other places in Europe. At the same time, I recognize that what you say is true, that individual Muslim citizens in this country are pissed off, and they ought to be pissed off as Americans, that, you know, this country, well, let's face it, we have a crime ring of sicko mass murderers cloaked in the legitimacy of the government of the United States.
Well, yeah, you know, the thing is that I'm not saying everybody be afraid of our Muslims, because the reason why these, you know, like, people came here from the Middle East, the ones that came here, they didn't come here because they hate us and they hate our system and our culture. It's because they like our culture and they want to become part of it. And they do become part of our country. But I'm saying that since 9/11 and, you know, the invasion of Iraq, they're starting to feel not welcome and they're becoming more and more angry. And I think that this is possibly the greatest danger that we face from Al-Qaeda's attack, is that we're radicalizing our own population in response to it.
Yep. Yeah, I agree with you, and I understand. I wasn't trying to mischaracterize you. I know that you weren't like putting out a warning about our neighbors or anything. I just wanted to be very clear on that, you know, for its own sake. But no, I mean, I totally agree with you, and that's the point of terrorism. That's how it works. The action is in the reaction. You know, you basically you trick America into overreacting and doing something crazy, and so that you can say, see how evil they are. And really, of course, it works the same way on our side, doesn't it? Keep provoking the attack, not necessarily deliberately, perhaps, but not necessarily, but you just keep doing things that you know, basically slap them in the face until they do something rash. The action is in the reaction. Then we get to point at them and say, see how evil they are? And the war party on both sides does this and plays off of this. And it's our job to recognize that, you know, they're trying to manipulate our reactions and to not fall for it. You know, that's how you defeat terrorism, is you react in a way, you know, opposite as best you can from what they were trying to get you to do.
Yeah, it's the classic trap of terrorism, and this is why William Lynn says that the moral component of fourth generation warfare is the most important. This is a perfect example of what he's calling the moral component, is that you're able, through the person's reaction to what you've done, that when it's worse than what you've done, then you're able to say, look how evil they are. And yeah. Then the government begins to lose popular support as they become more and more authoritative and forceful in their response to the terrorism. They lose more and more support. And despite what people, a lot of people think, you can't really run a government without popular support.
Yeah, that's right. Look at what's going on in Iraq. Look at the way it worked in Vietnam. You know, they tried government after government after government. So will you support this one? And at the end of the day, you know, they were simply Vichy governments being propped up by a foreign power. And no, the people would not support them. So they fell. And, you know, you got to figure, especially an example like Vietnam, boy, the alternative was not very handsome. You know, the alternative was Ho Chi Minh and his death squads. And those guys were brutal. But,
yeah, whose death squads are more likely to come after me?
Right, yeah. And I think, you know, there were a lot of people in Vietnam who threw in their lot with the Americans as long as they could. But at the end of the day, you know, being foreigners who look and speak and believe differently, that foreign occupation is just not tenable. And, you know, Americans shouldn't even have to be learning this lesson. Why the hell would we want to colonially occupy anyone anyway? I mean, if they really wanted to create a democracy in Iraq, all they had to do was, you know, put together a council of people mostly representative of the different factions and say, you know, we suggest you guys hold elections. Bye. And they didn't do that. I mean, we're colonially occupying. The news came out over the weekend. ABC News, I don't know if you saw this, Sean. ABC News posted it and then pulled it down. The plans are America's staying in Iraq through 2009 at least. There ain't no pulling out of Iraq. I don't know if you saw on the anti-war blog, we posted all the pictures of the plans for the American embassy there. You know, this is a colonial occupying presence. And you know what I predict? I predict it's going to end the same way as Vietnam. And we're going to see helicopters taken off from the roof of that embassy as the green zone is overrun.
Well, you know, we have a classic... we have a classic struggle that's going on in this country that's really underground, and it's been going on for probably a little over 100 years now, which is there's a group of people, mostly elite politicians and rich people and military people, who want an empire. And then there's ordinary Joe Blow Americans who don't really want an empire, who really just want to stay at home and raise their families and watch television and then go out boating on the weekends and enjoy their lives.
Right.
And so, you know, we've got this group of people who are always trying to want to do things like occupy another country. So they tell the Americans that they can, you know, go over and have a war and then come home. Well, you don't come home from an occupation. That's why they call it an occupation. You know, the Romans never came home from any of the countries that they conquered.
Not till they were forced out.
Yeah, yeah. Once they conquered a country, you know, they had to keep troops there. That's one of the reasons they fell.
Yeah,
they kept on conquering countries, and they kept on needing more and more troops, and they had less and less money to actually pay these troops.
Right, because they refused to recognize the consequences of their behavior. Why? We're an empire now. We create our own reality. We do things the way we want. I mean, I don't know if you saw any of the Democrat debate last night, but Joe Biden is going, look, people are dying in Darfur. Okay, yeah. And so America's got to invade Darfur. Man,
there's not enough troops in the world to go and solve the conflicts that are, if you went everywhere that people were dying in Africa.
Yeah, well, and never even mind that. Sudan is exactly where bin Laden wants us to go, the actual enemy, Al-Qaeda. Look, I talked with Bob Pape Friday. I'm sure you heard the show. Bob Pape said, look, radical Sunni Salafist Islam is very strong in Sudan, so strong that bin Laden was welcome there for a time in the 1990s. We all remember well. And he said, guess what? In Sudan, they've never had a suicide bombing. You know why? Because they don't have foreign occupation. They have civil war, unending civil war. If it's not in the south, it's in the west. But they never have suicide terrorism. Well, what's going to happen when you put Yankees on the ground with machine guns in Sudan? You're going to make bin Laden's dream come true, spread the whole war on terror, so-called, to Africa now? And not one Democrat on that stage last night said, now, wait a minute, there are consequences when America goes intervening overseas. You can't just go around doing this like you create your own reality.
Well, and, you know, I read this article, and I can't remember who wrote it, but naturally I linked to it from antiwar.com. And it was about the some of those consequences. You know, the thing is that one of the things that's going on in Darfur is that there's these people who are rebelling against the government. And sometimes when you have one of these groups, they just need to give it up. And when you send in some foreign troops to, quote, quote, protect them from the big bad government, what you end up doing is prolonging the conflict by actually adding more manpower to a cause that's already lost.
Right, and associating those people involved in that lost cause with the foreign occupying imperial enemy, which is certainly better for them in the long term.
So, you know, the thing is that there's this group of rebels that it's not going to do any good to go ahead and back these rebels. They're not really any better than the government there, and it's just going to prolong the conflict. And there's a whole bunch of people who are caught in the middle, I'm sure, that don't care anything about the rebellion against the government, don't care anything about the government. They just want to plant their fields and tend their animals and move on with their lives.
Well, let me ask you this, Shauna. Do you know, I know that I don't have the information. I'd like to find out. But why is it that the people who are the victims of the Janjaweed militias there are not armed to the teeth themselves? Can American private interests not just go and sell AK-47s to these people so that they can shoot back?
Well, you know, that one thing is that they are supposedly backed by the rebels. So one would suppose that there are some weapons available to them. Now, I know that the Sudanese government has been accused of providing air power for the Janjaweed.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, when they go in and they swoop down in this village, there's a couple of planes that are backing them up to really, really make the devastation work.
Yeah.
Well, so that, you know, that would mean that they're just being basically outmanned. And also, you're, I think, dealing with some, in the case of the Janjaweed, it's pretty hard to know who they are because no one ever talks to them in the press other than to try to prove that the Sudanese government is backing them up. That's all the information they ever want from these people. It's not like, who are you? Why are you attacking these villages or anything like that? But
yeah. Well,
if they are nomads, then it's going to be a lot harder to pin down and actually make a devastating attack on them because you may not know where they are. They're moving from place to place. Whereas with the other group of people, these are farmers who have established villages. And
yeah.
So, you know, there's a target there to hit.
Well, you know, last night Joe Biden wanted to make it sound like, oh, yeah, we'll just put in some guys, we'll take out the Janjaweed, no problem whatsoever, and then we'll leave. But I think that's a damned lie because my friend Bill Kelsey, Shauna, who you know is a pilot for a non-governmental organization that does relief missions all over Africa, he's been to Sudan and the refugee camps in Chad next door over and over again. And he says it is not that way at all. That, you know, it's much more like you described. Very hard to pick out who's who and who's the aggressor and who's the defender at any given moment, etc.
Well, the Janjaweed, from what I understand, are people who have been displaced by changing weather patterns. All over Africa, the Sahara Desert is basically spreading and becoming larger. There are more and more areas where that they're becoming uninhabitable there. So you have these people who were living in an area with their animals, and now they can't. There's no water there, and so they're not in a viable place. So they're moving. This is wow, classic. This is what happened a lot with the barbarian tribes that overran Rome. Mm-hmm. You know, as one group gets displaced for whatever reason, then they start moving on looking for another place.
I think the bottom line here is that when you're talking about desert spreading around and nomads versus tomato farmers and all this kind of stuff, what you're talking about is stuff that is outside the jurisdiction of the United States government as created by the Constitution of 1789. It is not our business. The government of America's job is within the law to protect the lives and liberties of the American people from foreign attack. And if America intervenes in Sudan, that runs exactly counter to the American government's obligation to the people of this country.
And, well, and
it will create more enemies for us in the name of benefiting somebody else who we all know it won't really benefit anyway. And I don't know what thought process has to, you know, what gears turn in the mind of a liberal who says out of Iraq and into Darfur. As, you know, they're addressing Dick Cheney and saying, Dick Cheney, we want you to please stop this war and start another one. And this is the liberal left because someone put the word humanitarian on it or something. This is a country which will turn, when America turns Sudan into a failed state like we did Iraq, we will see a brand new generation of African jihadists to excuse more interventionism in Africa probably for decades to come. This does not serve the interests of the American people at all. Humanitarianism be damned.
And it seems like rather than war, the answer is to help the people find ways to share their resources. You know, instead of sending over a bunch of soldiers, maybe, you know, those good leftists could pay for some good strong fences for the farmers so that the animals won't trample their fields. You know, there's a whole thing that, you know, you have to have a strong fence, and you know, the animal herder can't look at every animal all the time. So, you know, it doesn't do any good to say, hey, keep your animals out of my field. Sometimes you just can't. And fences are very expensive. All right. So some fences, some roads to the water supplies, for centuries over in parts of the world, like, you know, the Middle East and Africa, watering holes have been shared according to, you know, you've got a certain amount of time per day with your animals. Or, you know, to turn on the irrigation to your fields or whatever. So an arbitration on how to share resources and some ways to make it feasible for them to share the resources. This would be how to create peace in Darfur if that's what you really want.
Yeah. And you know, also I think we got to recognize, too, that sometimes you have conflicts that go back hundreds of years, thousands of years even, that, you know, at least in this case, I don't know exactly, but I guess the Belgians or the French or the British or somebody drew the border of Sudan in the first place. You're talking about tribes who've been at conflict for various reasons going back all through history. And there's some things that are just none of our damn business and not within our ability to do anything about one way or another, privately, publicly, or any other way. Sometimes we just have to recognize that, you know, we're glad we don't live in fucking Sudan, you know, and leave it at that.
Yeah, sometimes the dogs are going to fight, and you better not be in the middle.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Shauna, let me cut you loose here.
Actually, I wanted to bring up one more thing about Sudan.
All right, go ahead.
Which is how it's actually playing right into Cheney's hands. I've really been thinking a lot about this thing about what Cheney's up to in foreign policy is the scorched earth thing. That, you know, if you read Project for the New American Century or anything about it, it's pretty easy to see that in Cheney's mind, the big enemy out there is Russia and China. If we want to be the only big guy on the block, we've got to take down these two guys before they get big enough to really challenge our position.
That's right. And China has a lot of influence and power in Sudan as it is right now.
Yes, yes. Actually, the Chinese have signed a lot of deals with the Sudanese government to develop oil fields and gas fields there.
Mm-hmm. In the south.
So, you know, if they can get Sudan all torn up, then the Chinese won't be able to effectively, you know, get in and actually get their resources out of it. Which, you know, Iraq, we weren't buying Iraq oil. Other people were. Now they don't get that oil. And if he can get Iran all torn up, that, you know, Iran supplies both Russia and China, then he can keep their supplies all torn up.
Yeah. Well, you know, Shauna, this goes right back to the previous caller and Ted Koppel's admission that it's worth it for all these people to die in order for us to maintain this empire. It's just not true. You know, as I mentioned to the caller, and I think he probably already knew about it anyway, the Cato Institute did a study back in the 90s where they said we spend as much on the military going around killing people in the name of securing these resources as we actually do on the oil. And the fact of the matter is, anyone who even considers himself any sort of right winger at all ought to understand that, you know, whether they're Dick Cheney or, you know, a pure libertarian anarcho-capitalist, ought to understand that oil is a liquid, man. It is a fungible resource. And if Sudan sells all their oil to the Chinese, then that just means that there's less demand on Nigerian oil for the Chinese, and we'll buy Nigerian instead.
It's not about us getting the oil. It's about them not getting it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like, if we get all the oil we need and then there's all this oil floating around out there for them to get some too, then they continue, you know, their upward spot, you know, upward path to power.
Yeah.
If their supplies can be cut off, then their growth is going to be cut off.
Yeah, well, I'm here to tell you that China is here on this earth to stay, everybody. And, you know, during their rise to power, I think if they get to remember back and think of all the times that America screwed them over and tried to cut them off at the knees over and over again on their way up, that we're going to have problems. And that actually, the richer China is, the richer we are. The more wealth in the world, the better for everyone. That's called human progress. And that there's no natural reason whatsoever for us to have a conflict with China. It is only in the minds of these madmen at the American Enterprise Institute and in Vice President Cheney's office, as you say, Shauna.
Well, and of course, you know, they're all what they're, one of the things that they're not seeing is look at China's rise to power. Is it because they're building the biggest military in the world and threatening everybody?
No,
it's because economic power. And as we move forward in our, you know, as the whole world in our social evolution, military power is becoming increasingly irrelevant, and economic power is the one that's gaining supremacy. And, you know, our guys in Washington are pretty much not able to move on with that reality.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, hell, it used to be that he who has the biggest navy rules the world, right? But they got super, and, you know, they got pretty good defensive radars and stuff, I guess, too. But they have supersonic ship-killing missiles, never mind, you know, old Exocet missiles, like from the Argentine War. They got missiles that outshine the Exocet big time nowadays. And even, you know, our massive aircraft carriers are becoming obsolete. And can you imagine, you know, America losing aircraft carriers out on the high seas or in the Persian Gulf or something? You talk about ending the empire with a bang instead of a whimper. Yeah. All right. Hey, let me cut this short and play some music for the good folks. They've been very patient.
Okay.
Thank you very much for taking part in the show, Sean. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
Hey, y'all. The number is 646-646-646-646. If you're calling from out of town, 512-646-6446. And this here is Operation Ivy.
Get caught up.
All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. And, yeah, so, let's see, what was I going to talk about? I don't know, whatever you guys want to talk about, 646-6446, 646-6446. And I just want to mention again that Ron Paul will be on The Daily Show tonight on Comedy Central. Everybody check it out. The only honest, real constitutionalist, anti-war, pro-gun rights, pro-gold standard, anti-empire hero in D.C., the only one, will be a guest on The Daily Show tonight. And, I wanted to mention again that the terrorist plot of this weekend, the JFK airport, was a bunch of crap. So the FBI informant organized the whole thing. They had no money, no plan, same lies as always. I'll let you know when there's actually a legitimate terrorist threat to this country, right? Tune in. Okay, next caller's on the air, 646-6446. Welcome to the show.
How are we doing?
I'm doing great, man.
Okay, Scott, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate with you, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, I know that you're not a fan of government, but to the extent it does exist, it exists to defend people's property rights. Is that correct?
That's supposedly the case, yes, sir.
Very good. Let's say, and I believe that you include intellectual property in property, not just physical property, but intellectual property, patents, so forth.
Well, you know, that's all kind of debatable. I think mostly that amounts to protectionism. It seems like there must be some kind of line in between there, but I'm not an expert on that question, honestly. Butler Schaefer and some of the guys at Lou Rockwell and Mises have gone over this, but I'd be lying if I said I'd really studied it.
Okay, because I was wondering, vis-a-vis China and so forth, and a lot of those businesses in China are quasi-public, quasi-private. There is a relationship between the government and the Chinese businesses there. They're not totally private. There's a relationship between there. If it could be established beyond a reasonable doubt, conclusively proved that they are stealing intellectual property, you know, film. So and it's been established. And if the government is complicit in this action, and you do, to the extent that the government is legitimate, it should protect property rights. What action should the guy? I assume you don't want war with China, but if the Chinese government, let's say, if they have a plan to steal anything from knockoff drugs to movies, to you name it, across the board, what action, if any, should the government do to protect the property rights of U.S. citizens? I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
Okay.
All righty.
All right.
You.
Sure. Thanks for calling in. Anybody else at 646-6446? You're certainly right that I would never want war over such things. I think that the Chinese are learning more and more of that. The money is in protecting property rights rather than undermining them. Obviously, you have a problem when you have new technology that makes it where, you know, I can download a brand new movie to you over my instant messenger, you know, overnight or something like that nowadays. You know, I don't know if state power can do anything about it. I'm not sure if the Chinese government could really do anything about it. The American government sure can't. And I think they probably have relatively less government than we do when it comes to regulation about, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, I think ultimately the answer is people who make their living, off of their intellectual property are going to have to figure out better ways to be creative in making their money at the beginning and then accepting that their idea is going to be out there in the public domain to be copied and whatever. And I think that's just kind of the way it is. I remember as a little kid, every time a product on TV, from, you know, soap to candy or any other thing, as soon as one company, you know, makes some new innovation, well, we have tartar control. Now they all have tartar control, and they all pretend like they were the first one to have tartar control, but really it was, you know, this or that company did it first or whatever. And, what I want my government's regulations toward China to be is our Navy pointed outward, floating off the coast of California, doing nothing. And, you know, in case the day comes that they build 5 million troop transport ships and try to come over here. Yeah, right. And other than that, to have no rules or laws whatsoever. I don't think that America should have any tariffs or, you know, participate in any kind of trade wars or sanctions or any kind of thing like that, with China. As far as the WTO and all that goes, I'm not for it. I think it should be abolished. I think America should have free and open trade with every country. I really wish I was, you know, Bob Murphy, the economist or something, so I could explain in proper Mises terms, the argument that I basically accept, that's, you know, over my head, but sounds basically right to me, which is it really doesn't matter whether a certain country has protection against you. As long as people, you know, in your country are deciding that it's in their benefit to trade with people in that country, then it must be, or else they wouldn't be doing it. So don't worry about it. It's all good. You know, ultimately, I don't think America, the American government really can do anything about that. When it comes to intellectual property, I've never had, you know, I give all my interviews away, and if people want to copy and paste my articles and so forth, I don't really mind. I guess I would mind if they tried to put their name on it and say that they wrote it or something, but I guess I would hope that ultimately, you know, reputation would win out. That, like, nah, really, that was my article. See, I posted it here on this date or something. You know, I don't know. I know musicians who think that all this intellectual property stuff sucks because they wish that everybody could just download all their music free without having to worry about it. Although I think pretty much people can anyway. But, you know, ultimately, man, technology changes. And, you know, who's going to go out and buy a CD when you can download the damn thing, whether you're in China or in Austin, Texas, you know? I guess some people will. But it seems to me that, well, like the bands have figured out, the more people that download their music, the more people show up at their concerts. And that's where they make their money anyway. The record company always screw them on the CD sales anyway. But, you know, of course, they have their investments, too. But, I don't know. How's that for one big long rambling? I don't know. I should, wish Anthony Gregory was listening, man. He'd call in. He'd know what to say. Those guys over at LouRockwell.com have written all about this intellectual property stuff, and I don't know what their side is, and I don't really know if I agree with them or not, but I assume that their argument is basically centered around, what are you gonna do? Which is basically, I guess, where I'm at. Intellectual property. I should study that. I should interview people about that. I should interview a right-winger and a left-winger and a libertarian and a constitutionalist and an anarchist libertarian all about it and see where everybody stands. What do you think? So this is Anti-War Radio. 646-6446 is the number here in Austin, Texas. If you're listening out of town, it's 512-646-6446, and I guess I could be a nice guy and play y'all another song, right? Why not? This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Hoare. We'll be right back.
And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
My old boy from the point, but I'm from Southwest. And every now and then I get put to the test. But I can't be stopped, cause I gotta come true. Ain't got no gun, but I got my crew. Didn't come for no beef, cause I don't eat steak. I got a plate of soul food, chicken, rice, and gravy. Not covered in too much, drinking a cup of punch. Topical every last Thursday of the
Daddy
month.
Daddy put the hot grits on my chest in the morning. When I was sick, Mary had the hot soup boiling. Didn't know why, but it felt so good. Like some waffles in the morning, headed back to the woods. Now I'm full as a tick, got some soul on blast and a cassette. Food for my brain, they haven't stopped learning yet. Hot wings from Mojo's, got got my forehead sweat. Celery and blue cheese on my menu.
I'm gonna allow my body till I steal. Die face brooms around me like cancer drill. We were secondhand off the cuffs, but only to me. Mouth's worse, plus I'm getting pimped by this temp in a jacket from Optimus. Staffing niggas, laughing, set up clown, don't talk to me like that. Nigga, stupid, of course, living day by day. And you ain't hard trick, hell you say.
It's such a blessing when my eyes get to see the sunrise. I'm ready to begin. Another chance to get further away from where I've been, but I never forget. Everything I went through, I appreciate the shit. Because if I had a winner, took the ease away, wouldn't be the strong nigga that I am today. Everything that I did, different things I was told, just ended up being food for my soul.
Well, it's your soul food. Well, good old fashioned soul food. All right. Everything is for free, as good as it can be. Come and get some soul food.
Sunday morning, where you eating at? I'm on 1365, Wichita Drive, old bird, regular stove ride. Church to drop a chicken in yesterday's grease, then go together with this quarter midget. Last night, hanging over from a good time. Yeah, beef is cheaper, but it's pumped with red dye between two pieces of bread. Started to look good with them hairy legs. Wish I could cut her up, but my stomach come before sex. A house full of hoes. No, what's the ingredient? Spaghetti plus her monthly flow.
They know they're making it hard on the yard. Fuck Chris Darden. Fuck Marshall Claw, taking us when we in the spotlight for a joke. Changing by the day, I see it's getting bigger in my square. Bigger than Linux from the outside with the stare. No money to go inside, Tamika and Tiffany outside. Tripping and skipping rope to the beats from my Jeep. As I speak, what's up from the driver's seat?
A heap of help on the fried chicken, macaroni and cheese. And collard greens too big for my jeans. Smoke steams from under the lid that's on the pie. Ain't never had a lot, but thankful for the little that I got. Why not me? Fast food got me feeling sick. Them pockets ain't they slick. By trying to make this bullshit affordable, I thank the Lord that my voice was recordable.
Hey, it's so
Hold up, see, it's what I write. And Miss Lady, acting like we in jail, says she ain't got no extra hush puppies to sell. Bankhead seafood, making me hit the door with a mind full of attitude. It was a line that the beautiful JJ's Rib Shack was packed too. Looking to be one of them days when mama ain't cooking. Everybody's out hunting with the family, looking for a little soul food.
Come and get your soul food. Well, good old fashioned soul food. Alright, everything is for free, as good as it can be. Come and get some soul food. Come and get your soul.
All right, that one went out to Steven, who used to have a show here on Chaos a long ass time ago, who moved far away or something. You probably never hear this. Yeah, so hey, this is Chaos Radio, and I guess, what was this? Oh, I see what's going on here. Yeah, I tried to open up LouRockwell.com here because they apparently had the good clip of Gravel from last night. I figured I'd try to play that for you. But let's see here. Mozilla wanted to give me an update first. That was more important than me, you know, getting my business done here. So, let's see. Yeah, here's that clip.
Four of these people here will say that it's George Bush's war. It was facilitated by the Democrats. They brought the resolution up. One of them authored, co-authored it here, standing here. And so it's sure George Bush's war, but it's a Democrats' war also. Now, do you want to end it? You're concerned about what's going to happen after we withdraw? Well, remember Vietnam. All the dominoes are going to fall. Southeast Asia is going to go, communist. Well, how do we know what will happen? I do know this, that the insurgency is successful because the population sustains that insurgency, period.
Senator Gravel, do you think someone who voted to authorize the president to go to war should be president of the United States?
Not at all, because it's a moral criteria. And there's information coming out, Senator Durbin, Mr. Strum in his book, that really points out that these people knew that there was two sets of intelligence going on at the same time. And they made a political decision to vote the way they voted, a political decision that... Cost. Stop and think. We have killed more Americans than was done on the 11th of September.
When you
more
say,
Americans
when you...
died because of their decision. That disqualifies them for president. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means that they don't have moral judgment. And that's very important when you become president.
Yeah. Man, I like that guy, Mike Gravel. I'm sorry I kind of missed that first hour. He wasn't perfect, but that's pretty good stuff. That is good stuff, and he's absolutely right. Dick Durbin, who was the head Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, has come out now only in the last couple of months and said that, you know, I knew that it was all bullshit. I knew that when the CIA came and testified before my committee that they told me that Iraq doesn't have a nuclear weapons program and they don't have any evidence of stockpiles of weapons and that the UN got it all and there was 5% unaccounted for, but that was all just, you know, discrepancies in paperwork. There was nothing left. They knew this. Only a few months before Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State, said Saddam is in his box. We have him contained. He has no current weapons programs. They knew it was a lie. Mike Gravel is absolutely right. These Democrats say that they were duped into this war. They knew. They knew. Hell, I knew. If you were listening to Chaos in 2002, you knew. Goddamn despicable Democrats. All right, let me finish up the show here with Larissa Alexandrovna. Unless something terrible happens, she will be on the show tomorrow to explain. But I'll go ahead and get this story started. CIA running black propaganda operation against Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, officials say. Some intelligence sources more wary of covert Pentagon operations. The CIA has received approval at least twice in the last several years to conduct an information war against several countries in the Middle East, including Iran, Lebanon, and Syria, according to current and former intelligence officials. In addition, the Bush administration has been running operations out of the Defense Department that are not subject to congressional oversight. Remember what Philip Giraldi, former CIA counterterrorism officer, said on this show, beginning of last week, end of the one before that? Yeah, it's all about transferring the covert action to the military so that they don't have to testify before the Senate Intelligence Committees. As detailed back in the beginning of 2005 by Seymour Hersh in his article, The Coming Wars. In addition, the Bush administration has been running operations out of the Defense Department that are not subject to congressional oversight, intelligence sources say. These programs appear murkier and have included support for an alleged terrorist group in Iran. That's the war on terrorism. The war with terrorism. A recent ABC News report revealed that President George W. Bush had signed a presidential finding giving the CIA the authority to conduct non-lethal covert operations against Iran. Former and current intelligence sources tell Raw Story, however, that there have been at least two presidential findings over the past few years which have empowered the agency to run an open secret information war against Iranian interests, mainly leveraging resources and assets within the United States and France. Although the resources, peoples, groups, organizations were not identified, sources say that they are not terrorist organizations or groups using violent tactics to achieve their goals. It's a propaganda operation, said a former intelligence officer who wished to remain anonymous due to the sensitive nature of the information. It's not new or aggressive, the source added, explaining that the operation has been going on for some time and has congressional funding and oversight. CIA spokesman Paul Gimigliano would not comment on the allegations made in the ABC report or discuss the existence of the presidential findings identified to Raw Story. The CIA does not, as a matter of course, publicly discuss allegations of covert action, whether the assertions are right, wrong, or somewhere in between. That's one reason why the term covert action still exists, he said. But it's important to remember that through the Congress, there is vigorous oversight of secret intelligence activities. Yeah, vigorous. Dick Durbin's on the case, everybody. According to current and former intelligence officials, the various presidential findings are not limited to Iran. Several countries within the Middle East, including Syria and Lebanon, as well as groups such as Hezbollah, are being targeted through what sources call black propaganda efforts. Iran is being targeted by the CIA's activities with a pro-democracy message, sources say, and the agency is supporting overt pro-democracy groups. The program's particulars are highly classified, intelligence sources stress. However, that groups are being used, or rather, Intelligence sources stress, however, that the groups being used are rather mainstream and the operations are almost entirely restricted to information warfare. Sources would not identify what mechanism was being employed to distribute the propaganda, if it included news media, individuals, or organizations, or whether that information was seeping back into domestic news reports. Well, obviously it is. The whole bogus propaganda that Iran is behind, the sophisticated IEDs, the EFPs being used in Iraq and now supposedly in Afghanistan, that's pure bullshit. We've covered that on the show over and over and over again. Gareth Porter wrote about it in The Prospect and talked about it on this show. It's just pure lies that Iran is behind the bombings of American soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. Pure lies. That's obviously part of this whole thing. Anyway, one former intelligence case officer did explain that the CIA's program is operating largely outside of the Middle East and is aimed at identifying potential allies as well as using already existing well-known groups through whom information can be delivered. Yeah, MEK, basically, as a tool of the Mossad, as detailed in Target Iran, the book by former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter. That was my own comment, not the article, sorry. The type of information and the groups and organizations involved were not identified. ABC News may have reported the presidential finding as new because of the recently passed massive intelligence budget. Under the bill, roughly $50 million was appropriated for the Democracy Fund and the Broadcasting Board of Governors, both earmarked for Iran operations. Sources close to the Senate Select Intelligence Committee would not discuss any aspect of the CIA program or comment on anything relating to the presidential findings. Scenario I simply cannot get into, said one source. Pentagon operations supporting terrorist groups kept from Congress. Raw Story has also learned that the Pentagon is continuing to conduct more aggressive black operations approved by the National Security Council and the Office of the Vice President. Current and former intelligence officials would not identify new specific covert programs running out of the Pentagon, though sources stress these are far riskier and more truly covert operational activities against Iran than the activities of the CIA. These operations started almost immediately after the Iraq War and have continued for several years. Because they can be considered part of a military operation, they are not subjects to the same requirements for congressional authorization as the activities of the CIA. The majority of these efforts to destabilize Iran through a covert war of aggression have been carried out by the Department of Defense, largely steered by the Office of the Vice President and by then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. A series of Raw Story reports has identified some of the off-book or black operations running out of the Pentagon over the last several years. In 2003, the Defense Department began working with terrorist and dissident groups in an effort to destabilize Iran, bypassing traditional intelligence channels. One of the assets the Pentagon used was a terrorist organization known as Mujahideen al-Khalq, which is being run in two southern regional areas of Iran, including a Shia region where a series of attacks in 2006 left many dead and hundreds injured. These activities have often been guided by the same individuals whose actions during the Iran-Contra scandal were the reason for a 1991 law on covert activities, which for the first time clearly defined covert activities and how their oversight should be handled. During Iran-Contra, the Reagan White House, via the National Security Council, sold weapons to Iran, an avowed enemy of the United States, and used the money to fund various terrorist and dissident groups, collectively called the Contras, to fight a proxy war against the government of Nicaragua. Sources say that MEK has been used for intelligence collection, an activity which has traditionally fallen under the CIA. The administration also appears to be looking the other way, as groups such as MEK commit acts of violence, which MEK is a communist cult of personality around the widow of this kook who used to run the thing. Picture Bo and T and the Heaven's Gate suicide cult. Remember them? That's the MEK, you know, Saddam's terrorists that are now our terrorists. You know, that was Saddam's connection to terrorism. To be fair, he was connected to terrorism. The Mujahideen al-Khalq, who now work for the United States of America, murdering people in Iran. Intelligence sources interviewed for this article all express concern over the lack of attention to the Pentagon's covert activities. Some believe illegal activities like those of the Iran-Contra days are now being hidden under the loophole of traditional military activities to avoid congressional oversight. Stephen Aftergood, director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, says this loophole exists in the congressional oversight with regards to military covert activities. CIA covert actions have to be authorized by a written presidential finding, which must be provided to Congress. By contrast, DOD operations, including clandestine or covert operations, are not subject to this procedure, he said. As a result, there may be a temptation to opt for a purely military action to take advantage of the loophole in the congressional notification requirements. One more minute, almost done. Covert economic warfare may not be limited to CIA. Another former intelligence official said the CIA has been cleared to target Iran's economic interests, but that the approval is limited to non-aggressive activities. The CIA has been empowered to put economic pressure on Iran, the former intelligence officer stated, but would not elaborate on what the meaning of pressure is. Yet some suggest that the economic element of covert program is either of the covert program is either far more aggressive or is being attributed to CIA when in fact another agency may be running it. Foreign intelligence sources say that economic pressure is aimed at Iran's oil-rich economy, with U.S. efforts serving to persuade financial institutions, oil companies, and international investment interests to pull out of Iran and even drop already existing energy projects. These sources cite the example of an unnamed company that is being denied financing for energy projects inside Iran by international banks, indicating that many more such examples exist. The other possible forms of pressure would include less subtle activities, such as intercepting supply convoys and confiscating equipment. Foreign sources are not sure if this covert activity is part of the CIA program. The DOD did not respond to comment on this story. Muriel Kane contributed to the research for it. Larissa Alexandrovna at rawstory.com. She'll be on Anti-War Radio tomorrow. I expect. And so there you go. The war against Iran has already begun. It's been going on for a while. And, you know, God help us. Who's going to stop Dick Cheney from turning this thing into a full-scale war? God dang old hell, man. I'll tell you what. Anti-War Radio. See y'all tomorrow.
Here we go again, doing the same old thing, but that's alright.